Chapter 10. Bruce Shannon yawned as the company jet flew north, leaving the sprawl of London behind. This was the means by which most of those attending the Shannon AGM travelled, a special flight from London to Machree Airport and back again, as soon as possible, he hoped. Normally the meeting took a few hours, though if complex issues were on the agenda, adjournments, favoured by older members of the board, could see the family and its senior business managers marooned at Kersibay House for days on end. He shivered at the thought. Kersibay House had always been straight out of his worst nightmares. His older brother had disappeared from the place, so, unsurprisingly, his mother had kept him a virtual prisoner when he visited Blan as a child, terrified she would lose another son to the mansion on the cliff. Now, while there, he always felt as though his head was about to burst. Nothing to do, no fun, no sex, with only the local hostelry and dubious delights of Kinloch as any kind of diversion. His head hurt. He had drunk too much whisky the night before, though he had been sensible enough not to attend the party his American friend had organised after the pub in Notting Hill closed. Now that he was reaching his middle years, he disliked nothing more than watching younger men play the game of chase, capture, and reward he'd excelled at during his halcyon days. It wasn't mere jealousy. It was seeing it all done so badly, so clumsily, that annoyed him most. In his teens, twenties, and thirties, it was all he had lived for. The most depressing aspect of it all was the realization that, apart from drinking, it was all he was really good at. He was like an old sports car, still plenty of miles in the engine, but the bodywork was crumbling, dated by the shiny curves of newer, sleeker models. He looked around the cabin. He was one of 25 passengers, mostly lawyers and accountants, and including the Swedish global CEO Lars Bergner and his subordinates, Matthew Linton, Chief Operating Officer, and Charles Brady, Finance Director. Bruce despised Bergner. They were the same age, but the years hadn't ravaged the Swede the way they'd ruined him. No sign of a paunch, bags under the eyes, or even wrinkles. Bergner was the classic example of Scandinavian manhood, tall, fit, and blonde, effortlessly elegant. If this wasn't enough, he was intelligent, bordering on brilliant, with a hefty dollop of ruthlessness thrown in. In short, he was the perfect leader in the dog-eat-dog corporate world. He and Maxwell, interim chairman, though de facto boss, made an interesting pair. Bruce often wondered how two men so similar could operate as a team at the head of a multinational organization. Somehow, though, they did. The real company workhorse was Matthew Linton, an Oxford-educated former city banker. He was in his early 60s. Everything that happened within the organization passed across his desk. He wore his power lightly, in a self-effacing way that almost bordered on subservience. He was neat, efficient, and quiet, a grey man in a grey suit. He left the cut and thrust of business to Bergner and Maxwell, while he made sure everything hung together. Charles Brady was the only one of these three men whom Bruce liked. In fact, he supposed Brady was one of his dwindling number of close friends. A tough-talking New Yorker, Brady had the responsibility of controlling the company finances. With a turnover outstripping many small countries, this was no mean task. But Brady's burdens did not weigh him down. He liked women, drink, and gambling, and this alone commended him to Bruce. His cousin Maxwell hated him, but such were the complexities of Shannon International's financial affairs that he was forced to tolerate the thick-set accountant in his mid-50s. Brady, Bruce, and Ailsa formed a power block on the board, but that was going to change. "A large G&T, please," he said to a uniformed flight attendant as she passed. He was depressed to note that she stopped and whispered into Bergner's ear before heading back to the galley to fix his drink. It was obvious that the responsibilities of the CEO included how much alcohol he was permitted to consume. He was looking out at grey clouds when the waitress returned.
"Get me another," he demanded.
"Sorry, sir, this is your usual double measure.
Get me another," he snapped, drawing the attention of his fellow passengers. "And this time, do me a favour, don't okay it with Mr. Bergner first. Remember, I'm a Shannon, not him. I hope you've got that."
He felt vaguely sorry for the girl as she headed back to the galley, but he wouldn't be told what he could and couldn't do by some Swedish automaton. After gulping down both drinks in a fit of childish petulance, he felt tired and closed his eyes. But his doze was shortly disturbed by the captain. "Ladies and gentlemen, we'll be landing at Machri Airport in about 5 minutes. Please ensure that you return to your seats and fasten your belts. It's a bit snowy down there, so please wrap up before you leave the aircraft."
"You," he called to another flight attendant, "get me another drink, quickly."
Bergner returned his smile with a blank stare. "Fuck you," Bruce whispered under his breath. "We're nearly there," he thought. "I need all the help I can get." Veronica Moore watched as her husband traipsed back home through the snow. Her own boots lay beside the large kitchen range, steam slowly rising from them. The sky outside was a luminous white, and everything was still. It was as though their little part of the world lay asleep under its white blanket. A small bird flitted from branch to branch, flicking powdery snow as it went.
"Out walking early today, darling?" she said,
as he arrived in the large kitchen.
"Ah, yes, I couldn't sleep for thinking about that skeleton, and it was such a beautiful morning. I just wanted to get out and see the place in the snow. You don't get a lot of the white stuff where I come from, dear," replied the Reverend Moore, his cheeks red from the cold.
"You didn't take the camera?"
"Oh, no." He suddenly seemed unsure. "I never bloody thought. What an idiot."
Veronica poured a little hot water into a large brown teapot and left it to warm. For her, making tea was an art, a blessed routine that took her back to her childhood in Ireland. Warm the pot, infuse the tea, then pour. She loved the whole process. It was calming and familiar, like an act of devotion. She tipped 4 heaped spoonfuls of dark tea into the pot, followed by hot water.
"What variety of tea are you having now?" he asked.
"Oh, just plain old English breakfast. Give it a few minutes," she thought for a moment. "Where did you go?"
"Just around. Didn't want to go too far in case I got stranded. Big drifts up past Achenbury Farm. I had a trot about, took in the scenery. The place looks spectacular." "Did you know, a guy I worked with as a stockman, Ted his name was, big rough bloke. That was his one ambition in life."
"What was?"
"To stand knee-deep in snow. Never got his wish, poor bugger."
"Why was that?"
"Got crushed to death by a Mallee bull. He was a good mate."
She watched as her husband sat in front of the range and bent to take off his walking boots.
"So, did you see anyone?"
"No, not especially. Old Jock at a distance. He was walking across the low field. Gave me a big wave. That was all, really."
"Oh,"
she said quietly, looking out of the window at the footprints her husband had left in the snow. Bruce gazed out of the window as the jet circled the long runway at Machri, then began its descent. The aircraft landed awkwardly and then began to taxi towards the small terminal building. He was unbuckling his seatbelt when he felt a tap on his shoulder.
"You all right, Bruce? You look pale. That landing a bit too tasty for you?" asked Brady in his low New York drawl.
"Bit of a head, you know."
"Bit of a fucking hangover, you mean. Listen, I need to tell you something."
He sat in the seat beside Shannon and spoke conspiratorially into his ear.
"They found bones up on some old stone relic yesterday."
"What kind of bones?"
"A child's skeleton, you know what I mean? I wasn't sure whether you knew. I know our big Viking over there wouldn't mention it." "No, I didn't. What, I mean, do they have any idea who it is?"
replied Shannon, remembering the missed calls and texts he'd had from his daughter Nadia the previous evening.
Still running tests. The skeleton of a child, though, buddy.
He looked at Shannon with raised brows.
The cops are all over it. And they found a mutilated body on the road under the house.
What? Shit, what are we walking into here? A bloody war zone? Who was it?
Some paparazzo, down there to aim his lens at us. Listen, I'll talk to you when we get to the ranch.
Bruce watched as Brady walked down the aisle of the plane towards his very attractive blonde wife. He felt guilty about what he was about to do, but it was all for the greater good. An image of his older brother, taken only days before he disappeared, flashed into his mind. The little boy with the dark hair and rosy cheeks was holding the model train he had just received as a Christmas present, up to the camera. There he was again, frozen in time and into Bruce's heart.
"Oh, damn!"
shouted Veronica Moore as she watched the large plastic milk container burst on the stone floor of the kitchen.
"Honestly, I'm so clumsy!"
"You can say that again, dear. I'll get the mop and clean it up, don't worry."
"You're a darling. Listen, that's all the milk we had. I'll take a walk along to the shop and get more. What with this snow and all, sure we better stock up in case we get cut off from Kinloch."
"Wouldn't worry about it too much, dear. With all the dairy farms around here, I don't think we'll run out of milk too readily."
"Ah, but pasteurized is best now,"
she replied, smiling back at her husband. She quickly put on her walking boots and got ready to leave, just as her husband emerged with a mop and bucket.
"Are you sure you don't want me to go?"
"What, and stay here and mop the floor? No chance,"
she laughed. The air was cold, and the snow crumpled under her boots as she walked down the path. When she turned to look back at the house, there was no face at the window. Instead of turning left for the village, she followed her husband's footprints across the field. They were waved through the terminal at Machri Airport. No security checks necessary for these VIP visitors. Outside, a mismatched assortment of local taxis were scattered around the car park, waiting to take the Shannon International party to Kersevay House. The family could have provided a much grander fleet of vehicles for the journey to Blaen, but Ailsa had insisted that it was good for public relations to be seen to help local businesses, and no one had seen fit to gainsay her. Bruce shivered as he walked along the narrow ribbon of cleared pathway towards the nearest vehicle. He had seen a few light dustings of snow here over the years, but when he looked out across the field towards Kinloch, it was clear that this was no mere covering. As the driver took his bag, he watched Bergner cross the snowy car park towards him.
"Bruce, it's good you could make it," he said in his sing-song
Scandinavian accent. "Why wouldn't I? This is a habit of a bloody lifetime for me, let me assure you. Apart from the unnecessary welcome, what do you want?"
"I know you are aware that there have been slight difficulties in Blaen over the last 24 hours. Some unpleasantness."
"Rather more than that, I would have said."
"Yes, well, let us not stray into the realm of speculation. As you know, I only like to deal in fact."
"Really? How refreshing to hear that. When I was reading the last accounts, I could have sworn they were a work of fantasy."
"Perhaps an inability to grasp a balance sheet correctly,"
replied Bergner with a sneer.
"If you would like me to have someone with greater understanding go through things with you, please just let me know."
"If you've just come over to take cheap shots, then please fuck off, Berger boy."
"No. What I have to say to you before we get to Blaen is very serious. About your daughter, in fact."
Bruce felt a chill run down his spine.
"Is she okay?"
"Well, as far as her physical well-being is concerned, yes. As you are more than aware, her mental state is less so."
"Be careful, old boy. Don't cross the line. Not unless you want to celebrate the New Year in Kinloch Hospital, that is."
"I am only talking to you out of concern for the girl. I am informed that the events of the last few hours have disturbed her greatly. Remember, she is as aware of what took place here 50 years ago as you are."
"I don't need any advice about my own daughter," replied Bruce, wondering if now was the right time to tell Bergner about the alleged exploits of his own teenage daughter.
"No, indeed. Though I must tell you that, as a board, we feel it would be better if you took her back to London. This AGM promises to be the most important in the history of the company. We cannot be distracted by Nadia's histrionics."
"You mean that's what you and my cousin Maxwell think?" said Bruce, his breath billowing in the cold air.
"Nadia is a shareholder in Shannon International, a Shannon herself. As far as I'm concerned, she has more right to attend the AGM than you. Now fuck off."
Bruce cursed as he settled himself into the back seat of the taxi. Why was he so stubborn? He'd just spurned a free pass out of this awful place. Then he remembered he had things to do at Cursivay House, important things. This would be the most important meeting in the history of the company, but not in the way that arsehole Berger thought. He smiled to himself as the taxi pulled slowly away. The track stopped by the burn at the end of the low field. Veronica scanned the scene before her, but all she could see was virgin snow.
"Where did you go?"
she asked herself. She felt her chest tighten.
"Why am I so worried? What can I possibly think my husband has been doing?" "Stop being so stupid," she whispered to herself,
then walked back in the direction of the village to buy milk. Chapter 11 Snow was falling heavily in Kinloch. Daly watched it pile up on Main Street, where a crowd of people had gathered. In most places he'd been, people cursed this weather. Not so in Kinloch. Because of the Atlantic drift from the warm waters of the Gulf Stream, snow was a rare commodity in this part of Scotland. The town's populace revelled in it. The lights in the office dimmed for a split second before returning to normal. The door of his glass box burst open, revealing Superintendent Symington brushing snow from her thick uniform jacket.
"Good morning, DCI Daly. If this continues, it will complicate things tremendously."
"Yes, ma'am. If there's one thing we're not set up for here, it's the white stuff. I can give you an update on things if you'd like."
"Yes, that's why I'm here. I've decided to stay on for a couple of days, until we get this Shannon International meeting over with at any rate. You'll still be in charge of inquiries, of course."
Daly smiled as he offered her a seat.
"Not a problem, ma'am. Your late predecessor was a great man for taking an overview, but never missed a chance to grab the helm when he thought things were favourable enough."
"I'm not like that, I assure you," she replied. "You didn't like him, did you?"
"Honestly? No, I didn't like him at all.
Yet, I've read the files, you and he worked together for years in one way or another."
"Well, in my case, familiarity definitely led to contempt."
Daly opened up an image on his computer, leaving the conversation about John Donald behind.
"This is the journalist accompanying our dead photographer, Brocky," he said, turning the screen to face his superior.
A dark-haired man in his late 30s stared back at them.
"He started off in a regional paper in Aberdeenshire, then did a bit of radio. Moved to the tabloids 5 years ago. After that, freelance. Our rural patrol found their vehicle parked at the side of the road just outside Blan. Nothing much to report about it, other than it was located just across the field from where our skeleton was discovered."
"How could they know about that?"
"The way this force is now, ma'am, every bugger and their friend seem to be leaking stuff to the press. I'd rather find the whereabouts of this Grant guy than worry about who's telling what to whom. That's the job of the top brass. I'm just concerned about criminals out of uniform. I've had enough of the other kind."
"Point taken, DCI Daly."
"In addition to this, there were a number of break-ins last night in and around Kinloch."
"Not unusual these days."
"It is here, ma'am. Everyone knows everybody else. Miscreants soon discover the error of their ways. Real community policing in action."
"Yes, I'm sure,"
she said, looking doubtfully at Daly.
"So, any theories about any of this?"
"As far as Grant and Brocky are concerned, not really. We have teams of officers out looking.
The snow isn't making life easier on that front. I'll need to draw down more manpower from division, ma'am.
Okay, I'll deal with that. And the break-ins?
Nothing solid, but I'll let you know.
I think we'll have to be very careful with our friends at Kersevay House, ma'am. Oh, don't worry about that. I have a detachment of the support unit on their way. They'll take over duties guarding the house and free up your personnel. The Shannons have friends in high places.
I've no doubts about that. It's their enemies I'm worried about.
Moments after Daly spoke, the lights in Kinloch Police Office flickered and went out. After a few seconds, power was restored, but this time from the station's emergency generators. Daly called the emergency number he had for the electricity supplier. It soon became clear that the whole of South Kintyre was without power. Scott shivered as he left the county hotel. He'd had a shower and change of clothes and felt more like himself. The cellarman had been cleaning the hotel's beer lines, filling the lobby with the glorious smell of alcohol, making his longing for a drink even more acute. He remembered the young boy from the night before. He had been so real, so terrifying. Surely, if everyone knew the real dangers of boozing, no one would drink at all. The very thought of it, though, seduced him like an old lover. The calming, cosseting effect of a drink was a hard one to replace. He sighed. Across the road, he noticed the lights in a shop flicker out. As he looked down Main Street, he saw that every emporium was now in darkness.
"I'll be the power off, Sergeant," said a burly local in a boiler suit. "The last time we had a bad snow like this, it was out for near 2 weeks. The toon was fair starving."
"Aye, I'm sure you all got by.
You would be surprised. They had to put big vans out in the street, you know, serving pie and beans and the like. Hoorie, a cold it was.
Did they run out of drink?"
"Well, things were bad, but that would have just been tragic. See you later."
The man plodded on through the snow.
"Aye, tragic right enough," said Scott.
He heard his name and turned round. Annie was standing in the doorway of the hotel.
"Brian, can I have a wee word with you?"
"Aye, what is it, dear?"
he replied, trudging back on the snowy pavement.
"I've just had a message for my cousin Jessie. She runs the Black Wherry in Blan."
"Och, aye, that wee hotel. I passed it this morning on the way back to the toon."
"Aye, well, she's just had a message for Blan taxis. They canna get up Dury Hill 'cause of the snow."
"Ach, tell them to send another taxi to tow it up."
"Now, that's no as easy as you'd think, seeing as there only is the one Blan taxi. I think Big Johnny calls it Blan taxis to sound more important. You know fine how conceited folk can be."
She stopped as the phone rang in her pocket.
"Hello, County Hotel, the General Manager speaking," she said, in affected tones.
"What were you saying about conceited?"
She waved her hand to shut him up, listened for a few minutes, then ended the call.
"That was her again. There's no way anyone's getting up that hill until the snowplough's been through."
"I wish them luck, but I've got mere things in my mind today, Annie."
"Oh, I dare say. But you know they Shannons, they'll no take too kindly about being stuck in the snow."
"Sir, I have Constable Pollock on the phone from Blan," said Sergeant Shaw, speaking on Daly's internal line.
"Oh, if it's about the road, tell him that D.S. Scott has just told me,"
replied Daly, watching Scott, wet with melted snow, drying his hair with a towel.
"No, sir, I think it's something else. He sounds quite shaken up, to be honest."
Daly asked Shaw to put the call through. Presently he heard the wind gusting on the other end of the line.
"Willie, it's Jim Daly. What's up?"
"You'd better get here as quickly as possible, sir. I think I've found our missing journalist, and it's not a pretty sight."
"Dead, I take it, Willie?"
"Oh, aye, sir. Dead as dead can be."
Bruce pulled himself out of the taxi and looked up the steep hill. His car was in the middle of the convoy heading for Kersevay House. Near the prow of the hill, he could see a taxi sloughed sideways in the road, a number of individuals trying to push the vehicle back out of a drift. They were having little luck by the look of things, as plumes of freezing breath faded into the grey sky. He looked back down the hill to the flat plain beyond. To his left, the grey sea was dull beneath a sky hanging heavy with snow. To his right, darker clouds were unburdening themselves over Kinloch. He thought of his daughter, beautiful but so sad, so vulnerable. He remembered her screams when she was a child. The doctors had assured him that she was merely troubled by nightmares, which would pass. They rolled out the old maxims. Don't let her eat cheese before bed. Don't tell her scary stories or let her watch anything that may unsettle her on television. Don't let her have sugary drinks or anything containing caffeine. They had been wrong. He knew it when he watched her stare blankly into space, fully awake, then start screaming at the top of her voice. This was no nightmare. In her hysteria, she scratched his face and bit her tongue. Slowly, as he held her, she would begin to calm, sobbing quietly into his shoulder. Eventually, she had been diagnosed with frontal lobe disorder, a disorder of the brain that caused hallucinations. These visions were often dark, violent, and terrifying, but seemed mercifully short in their duration. Drugs and counselling had helped, but every time that look of terror passed across the face of his little girl, his heart broke. Then, when she was 8, her mother, his wife, died. Some people said it was as a result of a broken heart, others that the stress of seeing a child so afflicted by this vile condition was too much for her to take, and she had just lost the will to live. The Shannon PR machine had roared into action, ensuring that the press, or anyone outside the family, would never know that the cause of Hermione Shannon's death had been a pint of vodka and 2 bottles of sleeping pills. He cursed himself for his inability to cope. In the main, unable to handle his feelings and her condition, he had left the upbringing of his troubled daughter to her nanny and his mother. In effect, his little girl had lost 2 parents, her mother to the embrace of death, and her father to women, booze, designer drugs, and parties. He felt the shame and guilt wash over him. He had failed his daughter, his mother, and his dead father. It was time for redemption. It was time for Bruce to put things right. Chapter 12. Daly had to think quickly. There had been another murder in Blan, but with the road blocked by snow, he faced the problem of how to get to the locus of the death as quickly as possible. A snowplough had been dispatched to Dury Hill, followed by D.S. Scott in a Land Rover, to ease the passage of the Shannon party once the road was clear. After the events of the last few hours, it was clear that Blan had become an increasingly dangerous place to be. Scott and 2 constables were to be responsible for the Shannon safety until the party reached the relative sanctuary of Kersevay House. Daly tried in vain to conjure up the police helicopter before being forced to consider another option. He called James Newell, who told him that he would be glad to take investigating officers round Patterson's Point by sea in his large rib, currently the only way to get to Blan. Daly walked out into the busy CID office.
"Who can be spared from the Brockie murder team?"
He was surprised to hear a familiar voice reply.
"Me, sir. I've been checking Brockie's personal records. I'm stuck until the phone company gets back to us,"
said D.C. Dunn.
"Yes, well, okay then," replied Daly. "We'll have to take Newell's rib to the locus." "Don't worry, sir. It's snowing, but I think the sea's quite calm. I'm sure I'll be fine. I don't expect to have to fight for my life every time I go out in a boat."
"Okay. Point taken. I'll be with you in 5 minutes."
Daly returned to his glass box, where Symington was still seated, reading a file about the murdered photographer on a laptop.
"Do you think that's wise, DCI Daly?"
"Sorry, ma'am, is what wise?"
Daly was searching his desk for his mobile phone.
"I know you saved D.C. Dunn's life during a previous sea journey."
"Oh, yes. Well, the prospect of going back out doesn't seem to worry her."
"I also know about your relationship with her."
Daly stopped what he was doing.
"Ma'am, I don't know what you've read or been told about that.
Our relationship, as you call it, has been over for some time. As you know, I'm back with my wife and working my notice.
In other words, but out.
In other words, yes.
I'd like to come too.
Ma'am?
Don't worry, DCI Daly, I'm not going to tread on your toes. I want to be at Cursivay House. I can see we're going to be in for a difficult time.
She looked at her watch.
And we all have our orders, she said, without further explanation.
Though the convoy of taxis carrying the Shannon International party was only 5 miles out of Kinloch, it took the police officers in their Land Rover almost an hour to reach Dury Hill, following the large yellow snowplough as it worked its way through the drifting snow. Scott watched as other vehicles edged into the side of the road in order to let the large machine past and get on with its job. They sat well back, waiting until things got moving.
"Your man for the council tells me that once we're over this hill it should be plain sailing to Blan," said Scott,
shivering in the vehicle alongside three uniformed cops.
"I want a couple of you to go up and tell that lot what's happening."
"Would it not be better if you went, Sergeant?" asked a fresh-faced constable.
"Aye, it might be right enough. But mind, I've done my fair share of standing out in the pissing wet and freezing cold over the years. It's your turn. Get on with it."
He watched as the two cops, clad in thick uniform ski jackets, walked up the hill, slipping and sliding on the snow.
"Here, son," he said to the young PC at the wheel of the Land Rover. "Do you want a smoke?"
Sergeant, smoking is prohibited in all of our vehicles now."
"I'll take that as a no, then," replied Scott,
lighting his cigarette.
"Let me tell you something, son. See, if you want to survive in this job, learn to bend the rules once in a while. Otherwise, trust me, you'll go off your napper."
He took a long draw of the cigarette, his remaining guilty pleasure. Veronica returned to the manse in Blan to discover a note from her husband, pinned to the fridge with a magnet. "Gone to help clear snow from the church drive. Stay here until I get back. Weather's looking dreadful." She thought for a moment, then trudged out of the kitchen and along the hall, still in her soaking boots. The door to the Reverend Moore's study was closed, and she was surprised to find, when she turned the handle, that it was locked. She stood at the door for a moment, her head resting against the polished oak. She closed her eyes and breathed deeply. Suddenly she was falling, dropping through the air as though she had just jumped off a cliff. She slid down the door, barely able to breathe. Now on the floor, she curled up into a ball, praying, desperate for the sensation to pass. As quickly as it had arrived, it was gone. She uncurled and sat on the floor, her back against the stout door. She held her hand out in front of her face. It trembled uncontrollably. She stayed there for a few minutes, breathing deeply, then got to her feet. Instead of making the cup of sweet tea her body yearned for, she changed into another thick jacket and left the manse by the front door.
"Do you mind if I take a wander up and help the lads?"
said the young cop at the wheel of the Land Rover. His nose was curled against the smell of Scott's cigarette.
"You're all powder puff these days. See, when I was your age, we had to sit in police boxes for hours on end with three other guys smoking their lungs black. Ach, you don't know your living, man," said Scott, waving his colleague out of the van.
He shook his head as he watched him take tentative, faltering steps up the hill towards the jam of vehicles. He wound down his window and flicked the butt of his fag out into the snow, watching it glow then fizzle out. As he was winding up the window, he felt suddenly breathless. It was as though something heavy had landed on his chest, hindering his breathing. He heard himself wheeze, then tried to cough it away. As he fought to regain his composure, a high-pitched whine modulated in his ears. He could feel his heart thumping in his chest, and, despite the chill, felt beads of perspiration on his brow. As he struggled for breath, the taxis, yellow snowplough and distant figures on the glistening hill before him, seemed to melt away. The world was white and still. He felt loneliness and fear grip his soul.
He thrust his head into both hands in an attempt to banish the episode.
"Why are you so sad?"
It was a child's voice.
"What the f—"
gasped Scott, turning to look in the back of the vehicle. There, sitting behind him, was a little boy. He looked pale, but his cheeks were rosy as though from the cold. Scott felt his head swim. He reached for the door handle, desperate to escape.
"My name's Archie Shannon,"
said the little boy, just as Scott fumbled open the door and fell out onto the soft snow. Only his lack of breath prevented him from screaming. The whining in his head was so loud it was making his eyes water. Scott wasn't sure if the tears that were freezing on his face were caused by pain or fear. Panic was taking hold of him now. He grabbed at his tie, loosening it, trying desperately to breathe. He gulped at the freezing air, but nothing happened. "I'm dying," the words echoed around his head. Through his pain and terror, he heard footsteps coming towards him, getting louder than the whining noise in his head. He wanted to run, to escape. At that moment, even the thought of death seemed better than this hell he was experiencing. He was frozen to this spot, but by fear, not the powdery snow. The scene at sea was cold but magnificent. Despite the survival suits they were wearing, the three police officers shivered as the powerful Rib left the loch and entered the Sound. Daly watched Mary brace herself in the seat as the vessel's trim altered. The bow rose into the air, and, as they passed the large island at the head of the loch, Newell eased the throttle forwards. The sky had the colour and luminosity of pearls as they forged through the slow swell of the sea. To their right, the land lay like a white ribbon, hills, cliffs and promontories, softened by the thick carapace of snow. It was a scene he knew well, but didn't recognise. Even the smells and sounds were different. The tang of ocean was there, but somehow diluted. Though the gulls still soared through a pale, seemingly infinite sky, their cries were muted, no longer echoing from the high sea cliffs under their white blanket. Daly felt the cold sting at his eyes. Symington looked straight and confident in her yellow survival suit. Her sallow skin reflected the red of her life jacket as she turned her head to and fro, taking in all before her. Beside her, Mary hunched into her seat. For an instant, he saw vividly a vision of he and Scott making desperate attempts to grab her flailing hand as she disappeared under the tumult at Corryvreckan. Her auburn hair was tied into a ponytail, which swayed in time with the motion of the boat. Daly sighed, remembering her long hair brushing his face as she eased herself onto him when they made love.
"Another 15 minutes!"
shouted Newell through the vessel's loud intercom. Daly looked at the sea and sky, at the boy they were passing, bright red against a white backdrop, at anything, in fact, other than Mary. Soon he recognised the long sweep around Patterson's Point. They were nearing Blan. Newell slowed the Rib's progress, the hull easing back into the slick ocean as he turned the vessel towards the white loom of the coast.
"That's the beach we're after,"
he called, pointing towards a thin stretch of dull sand and rocky shore. Daly squinted into the distance. Already his senses were pricking. His experience, his feel for the job that had been such a huge part of his life, told him something was wrong, something was very, very wrong.
"Sergeant? Sergeant Scott, are you okay?"
He saw the face of the cop who had driven him here. Suddenly he could breathe again. The noise faded, and he felt the chill of the snow all around him.
Aye, son.
He was gulping down air now.
"I tried to get out of the bloody Land Rover and slipped. I've winded myself, that's all."
"You're soaking, Sergeant,"
said the constable, brushing snow from his colleague's jacket. "Here, take my hand. We'd better get you up out of this." Scott felt himself being dragged unsteadily to his feet. He was cold and wet, but he was still alive.
"I'm fine, son. These bloody shoes, nae use for this weather."
"There's a problem up ahead, Sergeant."
"What kind of problem?"
"The snowplough is making good progress, and the first taxi is back on the road.
We wanted to get the convoy moving, but one of the Shannon party is missing.
What the fuck do you mean?
Nobody can find him. His wife's going frantic. He went to help push the cab out of the ditch and he's vanished.
Who? Who's vanished?
His name is Bergner, I think. He's some kind of boss. Everything's quite confused up there, Sergeant.
Come on, said Scott, already slipping and sliding up the hill. We better find out what's going on.
Chapter 13. Daly paddled, ankle-deep through the freezing water, having jumped from Newell's rib. Constable Pollock and another uniformed officer were standing on the beach a few yards from him, their backs turned away from the grisly scene behind them. The dead man was in a kneeling position, his arms spread wide, each hand tied to posts driven deep into the sand. Daly walked closer, slowly narrowing his eyes, trying to take in the bare minimum visual information required in order to make any kind of assessment. The sounds and smells he normally associated with being on or near the sea were obscured by the sickening smell of fresh blood. This stretch of beach, bordered by snow-capped hills and trees, looked like a Christmas card, but smelled like a butcher's shop.
"You don't want to get too close, sir," said Pollock, now at Daly's side.
The man's ribs, cut away from his spine, stuck out behind him like the wings of a bird. Over each shoulder, two dark lumps still oozed dark blood, though most of it had congealed, black in the sand. Daly realized these were the victim's lungs.
"Fuck," he said,
already recoiling from the sight of this latest horror. He turned.
"Superintendent Symington, D.C. Dunn, stay back."
"Blood Eagle, sir. I read about this in books. I never thought I'd come face to face with anything like it," said Pollock. "If the sick bastard who did this was being authentic, this poor soul will still have been conscious while it was being done."
"What? You aren't serious."
"Yes, sir, it's an old method of execution, favoured by the Vikings, and some say the Druids. Horrific torture, agony, then death, reserved only for their worst enemies."
Pollock paused for a second.
"Old Mr. McLaughlin, who has Leddy Farm over the hill, heard screams, thought it was one of his cattle in trouble. By the time he got here, this was all there was to be found. The Force Doctor and Socko have been informed. I just thought you'd like to be here first."
"Nobody move."
The voice was calm and authoritative.
"I want everybody to look back at their own footsteps before they walk anywhere. The prints of whoever is responsible for this monstrosity must be here on the beach, or in the snow up there," said Symington,
seemingly unperturbed by the ruined figure in front of them. Daly looked back at the corpse. He should have given that order, made sure procedure was being properly adhered to. The dead man's bloodied hair hung down above the pool of congealed blood, obscuring his features. But he was certain they had found their missing journalist. A neat man of medium height met D.S. Scott behind the queue of taxis on the snowy hill.
Blue exhaust fumes filled the cold air, and the metallic rattle of diesel engines jarred.
"Are you in charge?"
"Aye, well, for the time being, Detective Sergeant Scott. I understand one of your party is missing."
"Yes, our chief executive is nowhere to be found. I'm Matthew Linton, chief operating officer of the company."
"A lot of chiefs where you come from, Mr. Linton."
A tall, attractive woman ran towards them.
"My husband, I saw him about 10 minutes ago. He had to take a call of nature, so he went over there," she said, pointing to a dry stone wall at the side of the road.
She walked through the snow, Scott and Linton in tow following a set of footprints. Scott assumed they were her husband's. The man had reasonably large feet, so his tread was distinctive and easy to follow. The prints ended at the wall. Snow had clearly been disturbed where the missing man had climbed over it in an attempt to gain some privacy to answer his call of nature. Scott stared out at the field beyond. Virgin snow, no sign of any footprints leading away from the road, and none leading back from the wall to where the taxis were still idling. A fringe of frozen mud snaked down the hill, in the lee of the dike, unaffected by the drifts. On the hard dirt,
there was no chance of finding any footprints.
"Where is he?"
asked the woman, in a foreign accent.
"Where can he be?"
Scott turned to the uniformed cop behind him. "I want you to go to each car and ask them if they have seen the missing man. Sorry, what's his name?"
"Bergner. Lars Bergner," replied Linton.
Despite the situation, he appeared unruffled. Most of the Shannon party had retreated to the vehicles, ready to be driven to Blan, but Scott could see another middle-aged man approaching. He was tall, his brown hair shot with grey. Though his face was lined, he was still handsome in a lived-in kind of way. Scott recognised the face of someone who, like himself, was no stranger to the joys of alcohol. There was also something strangely familiar about him.
"What's up, Matthew?" he asked, putting his arm around Mrs. Bergner, who had started to cry.
"Lars has disappeared."
"Your name is?" asked Scott.
"Bruce Shannon. If you're a policeman, you'll no doubt have made the acquaintance of my cousin, Maxwell, in the last 24 hours or so. Lucky you."
Scott realised why he found this man so familiar. He bore a striking resemblance to his odious relative, though with a different hair colour and less well-groomed mien, and with softer, more kindly features. He was also a few years his senior, Scott thought.
"First of all, I want to get these taxis moving, sir. Get you all over to Blan before the snow starts again."
Scott thought for a second.
"Obviously, I'll get some men up here as quickly as possible to try and locate the whereabouts of Mr. Bergner. But if some of you gentlemen would care to stay behind and help us in the search, I'll make sure more suitable clothing is brought for you from Kinloch."
Shannon nodded.
"Yes, count me in. It's not as though I've got anything better to do."
"I really must get to Kersevay House," remarked Linton. "There is so much to do. I really don't know what's going to happen if we can't find Lars. This is unbelievable."
Scott looked up at the sky. The clouds were dark, but with a luminous quality that foretold more snow. He took the phone from his pocket and pressed the screen. Daly admired the no-nonsense way that Symington had dealt with the horrific scene before them. Overhead he could see a yellow helicopter circling, looking for a place to land. Finally help was on the way. Soon SOCO officers would be able to do their job, and the ruined corpse of Colin Grant would be afforded some dignity.
"Sir, can I have a word?"
It was DC Dunn, her normally pale features rosy in the cold.
"I've had a message from the station. One of the Shannon party has gone missing."
She related the details of Lars Bergner's disappearance to Daly, who listened intently, then let out a long sigh.
"Ma'am, we have another problem."
As he told Superintendent Symington of this latest woe, the buzzing from the helicopter grew in volume as it came into land behind the beach.
"Okay, DCI Daly," said Symington. "You take the chopper back to Kinloch. I'll liaise with SOCO, then base myself at Kersevay House. I'm going to have to get HQ onto this. What the fuck is going on?"
Daly looked back at Grant's body. "I wish I knew, ma'am. I think we'll have to lock the place down once those taxis arrive, until we can try and make some kind of sense of what we're facing." He looked across the small bay. Tiny flakes of snow were starting to fall again, settling in the matted hair of Colin Grant.
"I agree. DC Dunn, you stay with me. The murders and this missing man will be your priority, DCI Daly. I'll make sure everything at Kersevay House is secured."
"What about the press, ma'am? They're on this already because of Brocky and Grant. When they discover the details of this little horror, things will erupt."
"We'll just have to worry about that when it happens. To think I thought coming here from Leeds would be a walk in the park."
"I know what you mean," replied Daly. "Trust me."
Two men in white suits were making their way across the snow and down onto the beach. Daly followed their tracks back up the hill, and was soon in the yellow helicopter, being whisked back to Kinloch. Despite the death and horror that was again enveloping him, he thought about Mary, wrapped up against the cold, only feet away from Grant's mutilated body, beauty side by side with visceral ugliness. It was chilling how seemingly tiny choices, decisions taken without a moment's thought, could shape one's life, or hasten its end. when Colin Grant embarked upon his trip to spy on the Shannon family, could he have ever imagined that he would lose his life in such pain? Daly had seen this all too often, the sudden violent termination of existence springing from the mundane. He had never really been comfortable flying. Large planes were the easiest. Smaller aircraft, particularly helicopters, made him feel very uneasy. Not for the first time, DCI Jim Daly wondered how and when his own end would come. The hut, tucked in a cleft in the rolling hills that overlooked Blan, was small and stank of damp and age. He stared out over the village, towards the cliff from which Kersevay House glared at the ocean beyond. Snow covered everything. Thorn bushes, fences and walls bore a white coat, softening them, blurring the lines and boundaries of the fields he knew so well. A small burn trickled nearby, following the tilt of the glen down to the sea. He had played here with his brothers so many years ago. They whittled little boats from pieces of wood and watched to see whose would sink first, the melting spring snow swelling the burn into a torrent of white water. But spring was far away today. He decided to make his way back down the path to his cottage in the village before it got any deeper. He was cold, but that cold made him feel alive. His body was beginning to fail now. Whose didn't at nearly 85? But his mind was still sharp. As he took one last look down the glen, on this, the last day of the old year, words formed in his head. The habits of a lifetime spent writing hadn't disappeared with retirement. Still, the prose came, words to make sense of what was before him, the urge to put pen to paper, or in his case, fingers to the stiff keys of the old typewriter that sat in his study at home. For the last 8 years, he had ignored these mental promptings and tried to settle down to retirement. He thought of his wife, the way she used to bustle about the kitchen, fussing over the old stove, baking, cooking, making endless cups of tea, making him smile, making the house that he now lived in a home. He supposed that in the modern world her tasks would seem those of a long time past. But then, he was from a long time ago, when life was easier, happier, and more rewarding. For what shall it profit a man if he shall gain the whole world and lose his own soul? The words from the scriptures ran through his head, where they had been ringing since he was a child, standing at his father's side at the old kirk in Blan. He had gained much in his lifetime, a praise for his writing, a nice home, a fine golf handicap, which he often cursed, a good life and a decent bank balance. But he had lost her. "Oh, Cathy," he whispered to himself, as he rose stiffly and made his way down the white glen. He paused. Though he was old, his hearing was still remarkably sharp. No doubt the benefit of years spent in the peace and quiet of Blan and an aversion to loud music. He looked across the field to his right. Something was moving. Jock Munro strayed from the path and went to investigate.
Chapter 14. Trenton Casely was rudely awoken by a knock at the door of his upmarket central London hotel room. The dark-haired woman beside him stirred and mumbled in her sleep. He struggled on his robe and padded across to the door, opening it to find a hotel porter bearing an envelope.
"This was left at the reception for you a few minutes ago, sir. The gentleman said it was urgent and should be brought straight up."
"Oh, I see. This guy, what was he like? Did he leave a name?"
"I don't know, sir. I can ask at the reception if you want. I was just handed the note to take up to you,"
said the porter, in a heavy East European accent. As Casely crossed the room to retrieve his wallet, he saw his female companion sit up in bed, her large breasts displaying magnificently above the duvet cover.
"Here, thank you. Much appreciated.
he said, handing a £20 note to the porter. Tearing open the envelope, he smiled as he read the message inside. He looked at his watch. They wanted to meet him in 2 hours. He had time to spare. Casely walked over to the bed and took off his robe. The woman smiled as he climbed in beside her.
"You've got a busy day, judging by what you told me last night. Don't you ever get tired, Trenton?" she said, in her clipped home county's accent.
"Only when I'm dead, honey, only when I'm dead," he replied, for a brief second wondering exactly what he had told her the previous night. Banishing this thought, he grabbed her by the shoulders and turned her over in the bed, making her squeal. It took him a few heartbeats to find what he was looking for, but soon he was thrusting hard, making her gasp into the white linen pillowcase. The phone on Daly's desk buzzed into life.
"D.I. Gunn HQ, sir," said Shaw from the front desk.
"Put him through," replied Daly, anxious to find out when reinforcements were likely to arrive. Gunn was in charge of logistics, responsible for moving officers about the division when required. The large area this covered made for a difficult job, but Daly liked him and always found him accommodating.
"Hi, John. When can you get me those men?" he asked.
"Sorry, Jim. You're going to have to manage with what you have at the moment. The road is blocked in 2 places because of the white stuff."
"What? Bloody hell. Can we do anything else? I have 2 murders and now I'm missing Chief Executive, John. It's getting pretty desperate here."
"We know the position, Jim, but this snow is right across the country. We're already down on personnel with guys not able to make it into work because of the state of the roads. I'm trying everything I can, I promise. If the worst comes to the worst, and I can pull together any numbers, I'll send them down by air. I'm warning you, though, it's looking pretty unlikely at the moment."
"Okay. I know you're doing your best," said Daly, then put the phone down with a clatter.
Since his arrival in Kinloch, he had been forced to draw down manpower from division on quite a few occasions. He had never really considered that the weather could play such a pivotal role. Why did nothing happen in isolation? Was he indeed facing the perfect storm? He walked through to the front office, where Sergeant Shaw, looking harassed, dealing with an increasing number of calls from the local populace who were marooned in the more rural spots around the subdivision, or having accidents on the treacherous roads.
"We'll need everybody in, Bill. I'll need you to cancel all leave and rest days. Can you get round everyone and see who we can muster?"
"A general recall to duty, boss."
"Yes, I know lots of the guys will be away for the festive season, but we'll bring in the off-duty shifts and see if we can find any stragglers. I'll get a cop to help you here."
Daly was just walking back to his glass box when the phone rang again.
"Sir, it's the mail for you. Not just the usual stuff, it's the editor. He says it's very important, something that may help our inquiries, sir."
Daly walked back to his office and sighed as he picked up the phone and took the call. The last thing he needed was to be deluged by the press, but he couldn't knock back the offer of help, certainly not from a newspaper editor.
"Jim Daly, can I help you?"
"DCI Daly, Ian Ward. I know you're literally snowed under at the moment, but I have some information for you. I've just come from the press conference in Pitt Street regarding Grant and Brockie."
"Ah, yes, I'm afraid the news doesn't get any better on that front," said Daly,
realising that the news about Grant's death was yet to be released.
"I know he was murdered. I know it wasn't a pretty sight either." "May I ask how you came by this knowledge, Mr. Ward?"
"Never mind that just now, DCI Daly. I noticed that your PR officer got something very wrong earlier."
"What exactly?"
"About the nature of their business in Blan. Grant and Brockie weren't in your area to dig up dirt on the Shannons."
"No?" "No doubt they were here studying new crop rotation methods," replied Daly.
"Nothing of the kind. They were following up reports of some kind of cult."
"What?" It took Daly a few moments to assimilate what Ward had just said.
"What do you mean by cult?"
"Oh, you know, dodgy rituals, group sex, that kind of thing. We had a tip-off some time ago."
Ward went on to tell Daly that the paper had been sent some grainy images from someone who signed himself or herself merely as a concerned Christian. Brocky and Grant had been dispatched to Blan to cover the story. Now they were both dead. "I'll email these images to you. I just thought that it was important that you knew the facts. I really want you to catch the bastards that did this, Chief Inspector. You have the full backing of the paper, of the entire journalistic community, I shouldn't wonder. We are a dwindling band, but not without clout, as I'm sure you realise." We'd have gone with the images as they were, but we were worried that it was all some elaborate hoax. I sent the boys down, they needed the work, and I knew them both so well. Bloody hard for freelancers these days. Daly could hear the tinge of regret in his voice. "Thank you, Mr. Ward. Perhaps you could also tell me how you found out about the death of Colin Grant. Now, Mr. Daly, you know the red lines as well as I do. I just think there's something strange about this."
"In what way?"
"Apparently Colin Grant had been splashing the cash lately. We're not bad payers, you understand, but this wasn't going to make him rich. Freelancers have to be fiscally prudent. Anyhow, I'm sending the email now. Please don't hesitate to call if you think we can help." Daly rubbed his chin. He had envisaged a slow wind-down in his last few weeks in the job. It now looked as though he was destined to be assailed by one last flourish of horror and death before he could return to any kind of normality. His email pinged, and he brought the message Ward had sent him up on his computer screen. There were three images, monochrome, apparently taken with the aid of an infrared camera. Whoever had tipped off Ward's newspaper had access to decent equipment. A group of figures, Daly counted eight, were standing with their heads bowed. They looked to be wearing hoods, dressed like monks, Daly thought. The second image was slightly clearer. Daly realised that he knew the location where these pictures had been taken. The rat stone was easily identifiable now. He could make out the figure of a woman on her hands and knees on the stone, facing away from the camera. One of the hooded figures had grabbed her long hair and was clearly joined with her in the act of copulation. The third image was less clear, though Daly spotted something held behind the back of one of those standing around the stone. He enlarged the screen in order to try and identify it. He flinched when he realised that he was looking at a long, thin blade. He remembered Brocky's mutilated face and Grant's horribly ruined body. "Shit," he said to himself, as he stared again at the grainy images in front of him. Trenton Casely knew the place well. It was in a little lane just off Great Portland Street in central London. He was always amazed how well preserved these old pubs were. It was like walking back in time as he stepped into the oak-panelled room. Despite being one of the largest, most modern cities on the planet, London's famous past shouted from every nook and cranny. He bought a drink and picked up a copy of the Financial Times from a rack of newspapers on the bar. He sat down at a quiet table and spread the paper before him, taking the opportunity to keep in touch with what was happening in the business world. As he sipped his pint of London pride, he reflected on the last 24 hours. He had arrived in London, a city he loved, made a deal that would change his life, and bedded one of the most beautiful women he had ever met. Not bad for a guy who had started life on the wrong side of the tracks in the Boston projects. He decided that, with the proceeds of the Shannon deal, he would buy an apartment in this city. There was something about the UK, London especially, that he adored. He liked to think it was something to do with the fact that a distant ancestor had left this place for New England at the time of Samuel Pepys. He smiled at the thought. Like many Americans, he was fascinated by his antecedents in the old world. The phone chimed in his pocket. "Running late. Make yourself comfortable. Be with you soon." Typical. Still, the beer was refreshing. He was feeling mellow, and he was pleased to read that a business belonging to a guy he had hated while at Harvard was failing spectacularly. Life was good. Being New Year's Eve, the pub was quiet. People were saving themselves for the festivities later that evening. A few people milled about at the bar,
as the English were wont to do. He was mildly irritated by a model of Santa Claus that shouted, "Ho, ho, ho," at intervals, and by a woman whose high-pitched laugh grated. He walked through to the toilet, the usual British standard, low, gloomy, and stinking of piss. As he relieved himself, the slight sting he felt reminded him of the sex he'd had earlier. In his opinion, there was nothing better than fucking an upper-class Englishwoman, watching that dam of cool restraint give way to screaming passion. Casely returned to his table and flicked the page of the large newspaper. Profits from oil fracking were reinvigorating the U.S. economy. It was good to know. He took a long gulp of his beer, still trying to slake the thirst left over by the booze he had consumed the previous evening. As he turned another page, he began to feel strange. His heart began to thump in his chest, pounding in his ears, and he felt his throat constrict. He clutched at his neck, struggling for breath. Just as he felt a wave of nausea wash over him, he was enveloped by darkness. He slumped forwards on the table, sending his pint glass crashing to the floor, where it smashed into tiny pieces. A thin stream of blood trickled from his nose and onto the newspaper, obscuring the article about U.S. futures. The woman's grating laugh turned to a high-pitched scream, but now it didn't bother Trenton Casely in the slightest. Daly had done all he could. With the help of local volunteers, particularly from the RNLI, Coast Guard and Fire Brigade, he'd managed to initiate a full search for Shannon Chief Executive Bergner. As the time passed, though, things looked more desperate. Though it couldn't land, the force helicopter had joined in the search, using its thermal imaging camera to try and pick up the signature warmth of life in the snow. Symington and Dunn had their hands full at Kersevay House, while Scott had been detailed to remain in Blan with some uniformed cops, just in case the council's best efforts to keep the road open failed. Fortunately, the contingent of support unit officers had arrived by boat and were now guarding the mansion on the cliff. Across the country, the sheer amount of snow was causing the new police force, Police Scotland, huge problems. As Daly had discovered, just getting officers from their homes to their place of work was proving immensely difficult. Despite the pressure, he had to think methodically, follow the little guidebook in his head, the instructions laid down by the great detectives he'd worked with when the job was new to him. He had three main problems, all connected in some way with the Shannons, or Blan, at least. Two murders, a high-profile missing businessman, and the break-ins across the subdivision. There was a small chink of light, though. In one of the homes broken into, an old man had spotted the thieves, just a glimpse, but better than nothing. Mr. McGuinness lived in a housing scheme in Kinloch, so Daly decided to pay him a visit. Despite everything, he had a gut feeling about these robberies. He tried to picture the photograph stolen from Hamish's home. Black and white, turning brown with age, old-fashioned photography displaying a glimpse of the past. Jim Daly felt there was something about these images that could help solve the rest of his woes. But as was so often the case, he couldn't explain why he thought this. He zipped up his ski jacket as he left the office and took to his car. The main roads in the town were being kept clear by hard-working council staff. He wondered how long they would be able to keep it up. Already some of the more remote communities on the peninsula had been cut off. He knew that a special effort was being made to keep the road to Blan open. As he drove through the snow, the street lights flickered, then dulled, their last phosphorescence fading. The power cut earlier in the day had lasted for 2 hours. He hoped this one would be more brief. As fat snowflakes landed on his windscreen, he decided not to hold out too much hope.